VCs start with a very big wide funnel, and it starts with a funnel of 101 options or opportunities. Think of that. It means that we have to decline 100 times. You have to say no to entrepreneur and to yourself, to that pitch deck and to that idea, to finally find that single opportunity.
Plug into the minds of the world's cutting-edge innovators, visionaries, and thought leaders who are rewriting the rules of sales and success. It's your time to make an impact. I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Selling with Love podcast. I'm very excited about the conversation we're going to be having today. As you've noticed in the last few weeks, I've been very curious about business growth, business management, and getting inspired by different industries that have really set models in place for fast growth, scaling, and really getting results that get to the global stage. And I'm so excited about having Alex Dang, who's going to be joining us today, who's just about to release his book, who he has co-authored, called The Venture Mindset, How to Make Smarter Bets and Achieve Extraordinary Growth. In the world of venture capital, startups, Silicon Valley, things move fast, things grow huge. And what we're going to try to extract today from the conversation are what are some of the key insights that we can apply regardless of our business size and which stage we are at to have the right mindset, to be building the right things, and understand what are some of the keys to success. If you're not familiar with Alex, you should know that the man has over 2 decades of experience as a professional partner, a manager, a senior leader at companies such as McKinsey, Ernst & Young, and Amazon. He's currently the CEO and general manager of multiple technology companies, and he's an expert in e-commerce and digital platforms. For any of you who are working in e-commerce, this is going to be a juicy episode for you. The book itself and the concepts he discovers are used in companies like Google, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, all the big names that you know. There are certain concepts they put in place that are dissected from Alex's insights, and we're going to get to extract some of these as we have a conversation today. Alex, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you for having me here, and you've set the bar truly high.
Well, honestly, I'm looking at your resume and I'm like, oh my God. Okay, first off, I needed to clarify, like, am I being billed hourly to have this conversation?
Not necessarily. More importantly, Jason, it's all started with a very simple role. I was a sales guy. That was my very first job. I was working for an Italian company that was selling security equipment worldwide. So I do believe that sales is part of pretty much every business. And more importantly, you might have noticed that we have recently published an article for HBR, Harvard Business Review, about the venture mindset. But that's actually not my first article for Harvard Business Review. My first one had a very honest title: Start with Sales, Let the Rest Wait. I do believe that everyone in this world is a sales guy, and therefore we have to truly understand how to be efficient in selling ideas, products, services.
Amen. Welcome to the church. This is what I've been trying to get people to understand. And I wasn't even aware of that article. So that's a fun news. I feel most people, you know, the biggest thing I'm trying to kind of unravel is this resistance to sales. I'd just be curious, like, I see this particularly in the face of people that are like mission-driven entrepreneurs or maybe like spiritual-minded, trying to do good in the world, seems to have a natural resistance to sales. I'd be curious to know, in the field of like founders, Silicon Valley, maybe a more tech-focused organization, do you see that same kind of resistance in sales, or is it just industry-specific?
I think it's a very natural thing to be kind of afraid of selling stuff. And that's all about the framing of the word sales. I would start actually with a quote from very famous, legendary venture capitalist, John Doerr, who backed amazing companies like Google or Amazon. And he noted that entrepreneurs and successful entrepreneurs are not mercenaries, they're missionaries. And I think that's the core to understanding why it's so important, especially if you were launching a new venture, a new business. And that's what we learned as we were writing the book. And the book is the result of almost 2 decades of research of Professor Strebel from Stanford. And I use some of examples from my personal experience as well, that it's a lot about not transactional sales that matters. What matters is the long-term relationship with your users, clients, customers, whether it's for McKinsey, where you build a relationship with your client and hopefully work with them and for them for decades, The same thing happens with venture capitalists. When they make their first seed stage or so-called Series A investment, basically their first money that an entrepreneur receives, they make a bet for the next 5, 10, in some cases 15 years. That kind of long-term focus naturally shifts the sales relationship or transactional relationship to more of a long-term bet, where you give and take, where you expect this person to grow with you. So that's the mindset, which is one of 9 principles which we define in our book, The Venture Mindset. It's the focus on long term. It's thinking long. It's making sure that whatever bet you make, whether with a client or with a service or with a product or with your side gig, it should be focused, especially if you plan to or expect to have return as venture capitalist, which is 20, 100x return, then certainly have to think long.
So I've heard the advice of, okay, we got to be long-term focused, but I might want to dissect it even more because I'd be curious to see what is considered like a long-term planning. Because I've noticed, especially in a time where it seems there's shiny objects everywhere, okay? AI has come out and it's like, oh, we got to go into this. And a lot of times I could be thinking about, oh, I could take on an initiative and like, we'll make money in like 6 months. Is that considered long-term? Or are we talking about having something that it needs to pass some sort of litmus test over, is it an X amount of time? I'd be curious to know what kind of advice you would give for people who are trying to find that one thing to go for and maybe are being distracted by these shiny things. Maybe there's a better way to go at this.
Look, I mean, that's a great question to ask yourself. And obviously, I think we have to refer to venture capitalists and learn from them if we want to understand how do they actually make all this innovative, extremely successful bets. How do they find Googles of the world, Modernas of the world, or Ubers of the world? How do they do that? They think long. And when we refer to long, they refer to years, if not decades. I mean, 10 plus years will be a pretty rare circumstances, but they are very patient people. More importantly, if you think about that, if imagine you're an investor in Uber, you have to struggle through so many years of deep losses and still have this trust. And to be honest, I would use the word from the title of this podcast, love. Love to whom? To founders, to people who joined the startup as employees, trust and love to users, which are currently, and drivers who are currently making sure that the product actually exists. And then one day that company will IPO or go public, and eventually venture capitalists will be paid back for all their risks and patience, but they have to wait patiently for that moment in time. So to address your specific question, it's all about at least 5 to 10 years. These are the bets which are making sense for venture capitalists. And we believe, after reading this book and after interviewing hundreds of venture capitalists and founders, that's at least some of your bets should have this kind of time horizon as well. The challenge here is that to find such bets, you may have to use another principle that we outline in the book. It is saying no, and saying no to many options or ideas or flashy, cool stuff which is surrounding you. And there are so many. I mean, even VCs, I have to admit, they are sometimes making some bad bets, like in digital currencies or some crypto projects. And there are so many. And you have to say no. And the question is, how often do you have to say no if you want to be in this kind of the venture mindset mood? We actually learned the number. And Ilya Strebelov's research suggests that VCs start with this very big wide funnel, and it starts with a funnel of 101 options or opportunities. Think of that. It means that we have to decline 100 times. You have to say no to entrepreneur and to yourself, to that pitch deck and to that idea, to finally find that single opportunity which will become your bet. It's pretty hard to digest and to accept. Saying no 100 times is also a part of the game. And staying still positive in your search for that 101st, which may pay back.
That's very interesting. Alex, as you're saying this, you know, you're talking about thinking about long-term, having a level of trust, having a love for the idea that you've decided to choose into. That seems like things I would have never heard from a venture capitalist, because I'm having a cartoon idea of what a venture capitalist is. And I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one where it's like money hungry, cutthroat person that comes in and guts a company, takes control, just wants the bottom line. But here you're talking about a lot of things that are like not making a quick buck. They're about long-term trust, love. That sounds pretty healthy for a partner to have in your organization. And so I'd be curious to know how much of the industry actually operates that way versus maybe a few of the bad apples that might be changing the narrative. Because I've seen it in sales. Like, this is the whole reason I have my podcast, is because most people look at sales as cutthroat, manipulative, deceptive a-holes. And I'm like, no, they're great salespeople and you need to discover them. And I'm trying to bring that kind of awareness to people. I'm wondering if venture capitalist has a kind of a similar reputation fix they're trying to work on.
Well, geez, I think the world is very complex, meaning that like anyone, VCs will have to act differently in different situations. And let's make a step back. VCs are making pretty big bets on something which may not be even described as a business plan. And in reality, too often may not be even described on a napkin, which is kind of a legendary napkin where business plans are drawn on. In some cases, it's simply a bet on people. So if you think from that perspective, when they bet on, we call it a bet on a jockey rather than a horse, meaning that they bet on people rather than on a business plan. But that bet is pretty important and ambitious at the same time. So therefore, then they start to pay a lot of attention to how the business performs, how the team performs, and whether they're actually meeting the targets that they promised. And in some cases, they're extremely helpful people. They're truly loving people because they want this startup to be successful. They are in this game. Their incentives are fully aligned or almost fully aligned with entrepreneurs. They want this company to be successful. But at the same time, they also want to make sure that they meet all the milestones that any startup should meet to raise their next fund, Series A, Series B, Series C. And therefore, we use so-called principle, and in the book it is mentioned as double down or quit, which means that in so many cases, VCs have to make a step back and tell to themselves whether they want to double down. Is it the right company to give more cash to? Do they still believe in the idea and the team? More importantly, the book is written about venture capitalists, but to be honest, not for venture capitalists, because we think that so many corporate managers, so many salespeople, myself included, had that idea that it's just all about failure is not an option. It just takes some time and effort and resilience, and we'll make it happen. We'll make this deal go through all these challenges that we have experienced. The challenges that, unfortunately, or fortunately, or what venture capitalists tell us and all their experience, or smart ones at least, that you sometimes have to quit. Simply decide that it's not the bet that's worth pursuing, that you may want to spend all your, more importantly, time and energy on other bets. And that's the challenge that you have to some extent, audit your own time schedule. Is this the right thing that I'm focused on? Is this the right business idea? Is this the right book, article? Is this the right lead, if we refer to the sales process, to focus on and continue to double down? Or it is time to quit, to have that energy to be focused on something else. So getting back to your question, and you asked whether they're ruthless, hard guys which will cut their costs and fire CEOs and control the company. They do. In some cases, they have to save for the bigger good, to make sure that the company actually can grow further. And in some cases, it's actually amazing to see the CEO who would grow with the company and scale in terms of skills, 10x, 100x, and then 1000x. It's a rare case, to be honest. So in so many instances, you have to replace the founder as a CEO with some professional CEO. It's never happening in a nice way. It's too often happening in a pretty hard way. So this is the reason why in some cases we hear and read about that in media. They can feel that perception of VC as ruthless or kind of immediate decision guys.
Fair enough. And to be honest, a lot of the stories that might be making the most media are figures that I have an assumption, and maybe you can confirm this, but we look at people like Steve Jobs as the case study, right? I mean, he takes a lot of weight into the space, obviously Apple being incredible. And you hear that story, like Steve Jobs gets kicked out of his own company because, I don't know, delusional, needs to grow up, has a lot of lessons to learn. And then we see him come back and then bring Apple to another level. And there's almost this assumption I'm making that a lot of people that are founders are like, you know, if people need to understand how I am, I'm the smartest. And it's almost like unfallible knowledge. And they'll kind of point to the Steve Jobs example being like, look, when he got kicked out, things went bad. That's why you need to trust me. So I'm curious to know if this story itself, is it more of a very rare occurrence that you bring back the founder? Or is that a very typical thing where the founder needs to leave? And has it led to any kind of delusions from people that come in?
It happened, Jason, it happened multiple times. Of course, it happened with Apple, it happened with Twitter. And when the founder who is in love with the company that he or she founded, that makes a big difference. I think it's all about this long-term mindset and love to the company and to users. And we use Steve Jobs and many other examples of founders as excellent examples of venture-minded executives or venture-minded leaders. Because we don't think that venture mindset is limited to venture capital. And that's the reason why we wrote this book, because we think that it's more of a framework how to make important high-stakes decisions. And we think that Steve Jobs made so many right decisions. He made so many wonderful bets, which could be easily demonstrated right here online. That's the product that never existed. It's a big bet, which became a big growth engine.
And for those who are just listening, we are pointing to an Apple Watch that is on Alex's wrist right now.
Thank you for this comment, Jason. And I can also point to iPhone, which itself is a product which became a new growth engine. And the reason for that, the core belief that we believe drove that constant creation of new growth engines is love. I actually would refer again to the same word that you use for the podcast name, which I personally love. It's the concept of lovable product and love to your users. If you build a customer-centric company, then your focus could be, may become a so-called minimum lovable product. You might have heard, and some of you might have heard, about the minimum viable products or products which are very early versions, kind of drafts, kind of things that may work, but not ideally, which will demonstrate whether there is a demand or not. And look, if any salespeople are on the call, I think they may hate MVPs because they may receive immediate phone calls from their clients. Hey guys, you screwed it up again. What the hell is that? And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, but that's the only way for startups and smaller companies to check if whether there is any demand or not. Well, larger companies, though, it's a huge risk. And that's why at Amazon, for instance, where I was a product leader, we use the term minimum lovable product or something that users, customers would love to use. So it's a bit of a higher bar. But that bar demonstrates the core belief of companies like Amazon, Apple, even Microsoft, that we used as reference points for venture-minded companies, because they focus on users' love to your product. They would prefer to use Google or Apple or Amazon products because they are so satisfied with the quality and with the service that they will come back again and again. And that's the why these companies even measure this, and they're very data-driven companies. They call it so-called LTV, or lifetime value of the user or the customer. And lifetime value is impacted not just by the transaction which are happening as we speak, but it's actually driven by transactions which will happen year, 2 years, 10 years from now. That's the core belief. And we think that that core belief was also tied up to this long-term vision of any venture or any business.
You know, this is really fun. I definitely want to encourage everybody to go and check out. I'm going to put a link in the show notes so you can grab an early copy. It's just about to be released, The Venture Mindset. Go to thevcmindset.com. You'll see some more details there. But in the show notes, we'll have some links to Amazon as well. Definitely pick up a copy of this because you might realize that having a venture mindset might be much more aligned with the type of values that you're trying to bring into your own business. Just thinking more long-term, of course, having love at its core. You're speaking to the choir here. I'm very, very happy to hear these concepts. And even this minimum lovable product, I've never heard this before. It's so genius, and it's such a thing I want to bring into the way that I launch products myself. So I've already taken that as a huge takeaway. I'd be very curious to kind of switch this to another gear, because what if I'm looking at my own personal life? Let's put business aside, and I'd be curious if you see things around the venture mindset that you're able to apply in your personal life, or there are a lot of the lessons in there that you see people could be able to apply more in their personal life to be happier, to be more successful, and to have a bit better results in their own lives.
Sure. And Jason, I'm glad that you asked this question, because our publisher, Penguin Random House, told us, hey, the book is already kind of too thick, too big. Let's keep it very condensed and very to the point about specifically innovation in corporate settings. Although we do believe there are so many examples and pieces of advice which we can give and share from the mindset perspective that can improve our everyday decisions, or I would rather say key decisions. Let's take one example, career planning and career decisions. And that's a critical decision which everyone will have to or had a chance to make already. And let's apply the same framework, which we just already discussed for the corporate setting. Do you accept your job offer right away, or do you actually wait for the one which will satisfy you longer term? The one which will truly bring your best, not just to the employer, but to employers, clients, customers, users, etc. Are you ready to say no 100 times as you are interviewing with so many companies in search for a new job? That's kind of an important framework to have in mind. Or do you focus on your bonus next quarter? If you meet the sales quota, obviously that's great. And then your bonus will increase. And that's a great thing to happen. But do you really value your next quarter bonus more than your long-term value or not? If you think about a startup is not focused, and VCs stimulate them to think that way. Actually, many VCs will get worried if you start to make too much profit, because they would think that you sacrifice future growth to get this cash to the company. And therefore, maybe you have to think the same way if you want to generate long-term value of yourself. Are you in the right position? Do you explore opportunities which will grow in the future? Maybe that AI space or silver economy space or health tech space or education tech space is so attractive and so powerful, and longer term, you may benefit from taking a lower paid job today, but with the longer term, bigger impact. This is again the VC mindset in practice.
I love that. I almost feel like venture mindset has a lot of these like father figure type of qualities. You know, it's like it's almost doing the right thing. It seems like not going for the instant gratification. And we're talking to a TikTok generation here where things are fast. And, you know, partly because we've developed such great products probably with venture mindset, but going back to venture mindset seems to be going against the grain of all the things that are pulling us towards get results now. The future is uncertain, so don't even plan for long term. There's almost like a sense of like, well, let's give up on long term planning because it's so uncertain in the future. Is that a trend that you're seeing with a lot of founders that are just trying to get in, get the cash in, get out? And how do you even counter that as a VC?
Look, as a VC, you're certainly worried when founders fake it till you make it. And unfortunately or fortunately, that's what happened to Silicon Valley. And many VCs do lots of due diligence in order to make sure that what they invest in actually worth what entrepreneurs and founders are saying to them. And interestingly enough, many deals which are currently famous, like Terna's disaster, that actually didn't go through the sniff test of many VCs well, meaning that many of them declined because they decided to test the product or just literally go to a local grocery store, or I think it was Walgreens, where they just decided to test the product and the test failed and they felt that, that's probably not the right idea to invest in. So look, we define it as two-speed approach. And that's something that I think every one of us may benefit from. The first speed, we can call it fast decision-making. It's when VC has to immediately kind of cut the funnel from 100 deals, which they initially considered, to say about 10 deals. And if you think about that, it's really hard to say no just by spending a few minutes, but they actually do that by using so-called why not to invest test. So create a kind of a checklist for yourself for ideas which you consider or for clients which you plan to address or target. And just say no immediately when you feel or fear that that doesn't go through your checklist. One flaw is enough to say no for such idea. But then after you filter out majority of your ideas or deals or opportunities this way, you have to immediately shift gears. You have to switch to your slow mode and do the proper due diligence to make sure that you do not accept your Theranos. You do not invest your time, money, effort, energy into something which does not deserve it. That's two-speed approach, I think, is critical for any decision-making, and especially for decision-making with high uncertainty, where the future is so unclear that you may have to apply quickly the first approach and then switch to a slower speed for the second part.
If I understand this correctly, it's just because there's going to be so many different things that are going to come at us at all times, we should adapt a mindset, which is no by default. And it's almost like if you say no to that opportunity, but it itches at you so much that it's like, wait, why did you say no? And you're like, wait, maybe I shouldn't say no, as opposed to just saying yes and then finding reasons to say no would save you a lot of time. You get to filter out a lot of stuff that you're like, oh, I just said no and it felt light. So let's move on to the next thing.
That's right. That's right.
And so once you've shortlisted that, then you actually start putting a lot of energy, because you could get stuck in analysis. Like if you have 100 deals and you're like, I'm going to go full due diligence, or if there's like 100 strategies you want to pursue, 100 leads you want to pursue, you know, we have a limited amount of time here. And as many as tools are allowing us to be better, more effective, more productive, we still need to have these frameworks so we can make better decisions faster. And this to me is just a liberating. I mean, like as you're saying this, I'm already thinking about companies I'm working with, and it's like, oh, okay, what are the strategies, initiatives, or priorities? Because I could be going for 100 priorities and I'm thinking, which ones, if I just go, no, we're not doing that, then it's like, am I bothered by that? Am I okay with that? And the fact that I'm okay with it, I'm like, well, it's probably a good no. Am I understanding this framework correctly?
Yeah. And Jason, you should be totally okay, because that means that that person potentially is a VC-minded person. Because again, our goal, our first chapter starts with a very simple title: home runs matter, strikeouts don't, which means that the whole business of venture capitalists is to find that Google and all the failures on the way, all these no's and losses, which you will generate, will not matter that much. It's all about that single bet, which will pay back for all the effort. That's how the business of VCs operate, meaning that they make 20 bets. Out of 20, probably 17 will be written off. Maybe two will be just kind of okay-ish results. And one will generate you 10x, 100x return. That's all about not missing that one rather than about all the misses on the way. Therefore, it's all about the funnel. It's all about the number of ideas that you can process, the number of opportunities and leads that you can go through, number of phone calls that you can make, number of meetings that you can participate in. And therefore, your constraint is too often time and energy. And if you start thinking about that as your key resource, then you simply have to say no. If you do not, then you will limit yourself to maybe 10 deals, 10 opportunities, 10 potential podcast guests. So, and you may miss the one which will generate 10x or 100x return.
Ain't that the truth? I can tell you worked at Amazon. Isn't there a quote that says, if you're going to have, you know, if you're going to fail 9 times out of 10, but one of the deals is going to give 100x return, you got to make that bet every time?
That's true. So to be honest, it was actually the part of the culture of Amazon, is that belief that failures do not truly matter. I mean, of course, it's painful. And if you think about your loss of the sale or a particular contract didn't go through, of course, it's painful. Of course, it's sad. As a product guy, we launched many products which we had to eventually close. I actually, in my office, decided deliberately to keep all the successful and unsuccessful press releases of products that we launched to demonstrate to myself and to my team that it's fine to fail. We do not have to be hiding these failures because it's part of the process. I mean, I never had that moment like Jeff Bezos had, demonstrating a Fire phone and claiming that that's not the biggest failure that he had and bigger failures are on the way, demonstrating the fact that it's all about actually bigger bets and therefore bigger failures. I never had a chance to experience that big of a failure, but at the same time, I think it's so important to demonstrate to yourself, to your team members, to your peers, that that's fine to fail. I mean, that's fine to experience that if you still explore some bets which may pay back for that.
That's definitely the parallel I'd see the most close to what I talk about in sales, because especially people that are used to going to school, getting grade A and passing tests and having good grades, there's a lot of brain mindset rewiring that's required to realize, like, hey, in sales, guess what? You will fail the exam if you're looking at your statistics. You're getting maybe 20% close rate, and that's considered good. And so dealing with that rejection, moving on, whether it's failure of your venture or failure on the sales call, every time you do it, especially since you've talked about the funnel, it's like, oh, wow, every time I talk to one of the 10 people, even if it's a no, or even if it ends up as a failure, I'm one step closer to that one that will do the fixing, that will bring all the results I need. And thus, you're just part of the game and you're having fun doing it.
That's absolutely right. And you know what, Jason, we've all heard about this 80-20 rule where 80% of your clients may generate only 20% of your profit or revenue, and vice versa. 20% of your clients may generate 80% of your revenue and be the key accounts or key clients. I think that's a great observation. But if you make a step back, someone somehow managed to get these 20% of clients and they managed to attract. Maybe your job is not to generate all the sales and process all the leads, but to find the ones which will generate eventually 80% of the revenue and have such a big impact. So hunting for these kind of home runs could be another strategy. Or our suggestion is that you at least blend in the venture mindset as a part of your formula and everyday life. You may not have to make all your bets in the venture mindset way, but at least set aside some percentage of your time and make, I would not say crazy, but kind of riskier bets. Some out-of-the-box bets. Something that you may think, I'm not sure that it will work. Test. Go ahead. Make a small bet. Try small. Scale fast. You can try small things. You can experiment small things. You can potentially find a new gold mine. But in order to find one, you have to make a bet. You have to make and you have to start with that small risk.
I love it. Alex, before I let you go, I do have the one opposite question, which is just, we're going here, we're talking about all the benefits of this venture mindset and all of the things that you need to consider. We talked about thinking long-term. We've got to be okay making risks. There's funnels you need to build so you have tons of ideas flowing. These are all great values, and I can definitely see that using this in a lot of the business stuff that I do. But I'd be curious, on the opposite side, do you see certain circumstances where you should not have a venture mindset? And are there certain individuals that you would advise against this kind of mindset?
Totally. And Jason, thank you so much for this question, because the VC mindset, the venture mindset, is certainly not ideal for so many circumstances. And I will list you a few. If you are dealing with traditional operations, day-to-day routine, things which are well-defined, where you can put together a so-called SOP or standard process, you don't need a venture mindset. You have to minimize the friction. You don't have to take a second guess. It has to be very clear outlined what to do and what not to do. Therefore, when you face regular situations or traditional business, I would rather apply to techniques like Six Sigma or optimization techniques, making sure that you can reduce the variability so that the result is way more predictable. However, when you deal with innovation, when you deal with new stuff, when you try to experiment, if you limit the variation, you will to some extent cut yourself out from the even the option to get that home run, to find this outlier. You will ignore one. And you will be afraid of one. The whole system will be against that. So that's why it's critical to separate day-to-day, regular, predictable environment, then just use the traditional set of tools, which many of us studied at MBA classes, or just from practice. And the VC mindset, reserve that for high-risk, high stakes decisions where the future is uncertain. That's where potentially you may apply this mindset.
I appreciate that. I'd say for all the important decisions, it almost seems like you need to have venture mindset, because things like, hey, what am I going to do with this life? Which business ventures or careers am I going to go into? What's the big strategy that I want to pursue as an organization for the next 3 years? That seems very venture mindset. How am I going to achieve my quarterly goals? I feel like I need a bit more traditional mindset and make sure people are in the right roles with the right responsibilities, with the clear job description and moving in the right way. Alex, it's been so fun having this conversation. I'm hoping I was able to distill some venture mindset for myself, and there's a lot more for me to digest in the VCmindset.com. For everybody tuning in, if you've gotten inspired, you want to bring this mindset to really shake the way that you operate and look at things much bigger, take bigger chances, not be afraid of failure, and realize that there's some major upsides when you think long term and you're able to apply this mindset not only in your business, but in your life. Definitely pick up a copy of The Venture Mindset, whether you're listening to this podcast and it's just around the corner to come out, or it's already out on the shelves. You'll be able to pick it up on all major ventures such as Amazon.com. Obviously, I'll put a plug there since Alex has worked there before. But The Venture Mindset, how to make smarter bets and achieve extraordinary growth. Alex, has been a fantastic having you on the show. And of course, I'm not letting you go without the key question I ask everyone, which is, what does selling with love mean to you?
Look, I think selling with love means that you care a lot about people you sell to, your clients, your customers, your users. So that's why when you start to think about this word care, word love to users, which will pay money today, maybe tomorrow, and eventually maybe that will become your loyal customer. But it's all about the care long-term relationship. So that's what this means to me.
Lovely. Alex, thank you so much for your time, your insights. Congrats on the book launch. For everybody else, check in the show notes. You'll have a link to go check more about Alex, the book, and to be able to bring venture mindset to yourself. Thanks for listening in. And of course, keep selling with love. I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.